The Story of the French Revolution by Ernest Belfort Bax. Author's Preface. The following sketch of the course of the French Revolution was originally published during 1889 in serial form in Justice, the weekly organ of the Social Democratic Federation. It has been revised, corrected, and in some parts added to for the present reissue. It need scarcely be said that it in no way pretends to be a complete history of the great political, social, and intellectual movement it describes. The present volume is designed primarily as a guide to those who, not having the time to study larger works on the subject, yet wish, during these centennial years, to have in a small compass a connected description of the main events of the French Revolution, more especially from the point of view of modern socialism. It is undeniable that there are many Englishmen who would indignantly repudiate any aspersions on their education for whom the French Revolution means little more than the destruction of one institution called the Bastille, the erection of another institution called the Guillotine, and the establishment of the Napoleonic Empire on the ruins of both. They have no idea of the complex forces, economical, speculative, and political, which manifested themselves in the succession of crises, scarcely indeed of the existence of the crises themselves, which took place between the assembling of the States General in 1789 and the suppression of the Babeuf conspiracy in 1796. For such as these, and for many others to whom the above remarks will not altogether apply, a condensed statement of the facts of the French Revolution cannot but be desirable, and although there exist summaries galore, the writer ventures to think that the present little work differs from them in two respects. Firstly, in the point of view from which the Revolution is viewed, and secondly, in the endeavour to throw the principal events into as strong relief as possible by the omission of all detail which is unessential to the understanding of them. Brevity has also been a distinct aim, and for this, as for the former reason, much that is in itself interesting has been left out. The foregoing especially applies to biographical details respecting the chief actors. These have been uniformly omitted throughout, as tending to expand the sketch indefinitely, and to draw off attention from its main purpose. The circumstances of the time and the events made the personalities what they were, and there is not one of them who, in so far as public life is concerned, can be regarded otherwise than as the embodiment of some more or less widespread contemporary tendency. The actors, therefore, merely cross the stage in connection with the principal events in which they played a role. Yet, though they may have suddenly become especially prominent, it must be understood that, in almost all cases, they were already familiar to the population of Paris, and in many cases of the whole of France, as club orators, parliamentary politicians, or as journalists. It is not too much to say that in the French Revolution, journalism first became a power in the world's history. Those who seek further details both of the Revolution itself and of the life of its leading figures may be referred to the larger histories. The admirable history of Mr. Morse Stephen, now in progress, represents by far the best work that has been yet done in English, both as regards exhaustiveness and impartiality in connection with the subject. Mr. Stephen's excellent articles in the 9th edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica may also be consulted with profit. The French literature of the subject would, of course, fill libraries. Works such as Bougeard's Marat, Avenel's and Acacius Clout's are monuments of industry and research. In spite of the efforts of French scholars, however, there is much room left for original investigation. The British Museum alone contains, I believe, upwards of 100,000 newspapers, pamphlets, manifestos, and other documents, many of them as yet unarranged and uncatalogued. The amount of material in Paris and in France generally, which has not yet been worked, is probably incalculable. Offence has been given in some quarters at the view taken of Robespierre in the following pages. The writer can only say that he cannot regard the mere negative qualification that Robespierre has been, in general, attacked by the reaction in conjunction with other leaders as of itself entitling him to the esteem of modern Democrats or Socialists in the teeth of the undeniable facts of the case. The treacherous surrender of the Dantonists, the judicial murder of the Hébertistes, the law of Prairial, are these things not written in history? The fact is, Robespierre was a petit bourgeois, a Philistine to the backbone, who desired a republic of petit bourgeois virtues with himself at the head, and was prepared to wade through a sea of blood for the accomplishment of his end. Napoleon had a truer sense of the case than other reactionists, when, as is reported, he was inclined to hail Robespierre as an unsuccessful predecessor in the work of restoring order and saving society, in the interest, of course, of the middle classes. With these few words of preface, the volume is left to the consideration of the reader, in the hope that it may afford him at least some light on the general bearings of the history of the French Revolution. Preface to the American Edition. The French Revolution is an inexhaustible quarry. Many works have been written upon it. Many more will be written. And safe it is to predict that something of value will be brought out in all. For all that, what has been brought out is ample to justify the popular sentiment that the subject is one of deep and lasting importance. But it is not merely in a general sense that the story of the French Revolution has permanent interest to the American reader. It is interesting to him in a special sense. Especially if the American reader be a student, he will find the story of the French Revolution to be of invaluable aid to his understanding and appreciating those features of the story of the American Revolution, without the understanding and appreciation of which the flavor of the American Revolution is lost, and many of the lessons of both are very materially forfeited. Same causes lead to same results. Here is a maxim as true as it is exposed to grave error. Causes run imperceptibly into results, and the reaction of results upon causes is so subtle that the two are often confused. Moreover, it is as important as it is often difficult to separate causes from accompaniments and properly group them. These are the pitfalls into which the superficial reader falls, and due to which the lessons of history are mainly lost to him. The story of the French Revolution furnishes an instance, and the instance is brought out all the clearer by comparison with the story of the American Revolution. The French Revolution, like the American, was the revolution of the bourgeois or oncoming capitalist class. And yet we find that, on the one hand, the identity of the cause is lost to many who, wholly unequipped with the key to the understanding of history and blinded by the accompaniments of each, consider them wholly distinct phenomena. While, on the other hand, others, somewhat but insufficiently equipped with the historical key, detect the identity of the cause, but relapse into barren dogmatism through their incapacity to distinguish between accompaniments. To the one and the other, the full significance of the history of the French Revolution is lost, and along with that is lost the pregnant features of the American Revolution. Numerous are the passages in Bedfall Bax's History of the French Revolution that furnish in hand the material with which to contrast the difference in accompaniments between the French and the American Revolution. Read with an eye to them, his contribution to the store of history is of great value to the philosophy of history. Material interests determine man's viewpoint. But material interests are, in their turn, determined by no one circumstance. The material interests that fretted against feudal restraints gave general direction to the revolt of the French bourgeois, and thereby caused its direction to fall within that quarter of the compass into which the American Revolution fell. But the exact point of the compass touched by each depended upon secondary material conditions. With the French Revolution, a sufficiently defined proletarian class simultaneously mounted the historic stage. None such made or could make its appearance in the instance of the American Revolution. To this secondary material fact touching France, and quite clearly brought out by Mr. Bax, is traceable a feature of the Revolution in France which imparts to that historic occurrence a physiognomy not shared by its American forerunner, and when properly appreciated, elucidates both. The utterances of the great figures in the French Revolution, of its great apostles, bear for this reason interesting comparison with their American kindreds. Both sets bourgeois, both sets, accordingly, resting on the private ownership of the means of production, did nevertheless present very different aspects. With the former, who, living in a densely populated country with natural opportunities already preempted, the declarations concerning the rights of man, or liberty, equality, fraternity, with the latter, who, finding themselves in an immense country, barely populated and natural opportunities accessible to all, their utterances included the whole human race. In the domain of sociology, no less than in that of biology, comparative anatomy is priceless. A careful reading of Mr. Bax's story of the French Revolution, for the very reason that it is synoptical, will not only enrich the mind on the event that it describes, but it will suggest home studies that enlarge the mind.
Daniel de Leon.
New York, October 1, 1902. End of preface. Chapters 1-4 of The Story of the French Revolution by Ernest Belfort Bax. Chapter 1. The Literary Prologue. The cardinal idea of the French Revolution was the political emancipation of the middle class. The feudal hierarchy of the Middle Ages consisted in France, as in other countries, of three main social divisions, or estates as they were termed: 1. The superior territorial clergy; 2. The nobles; and 3. The smaller landholders, the free tenants, and the citizens of the independent townships. The mere serf or villain, holding by servile tenure or common laborer, was like the slave of antiquity, unclassified. The possession or non-servile tenure of land was the condition of freedom. This third estate was the germ of our middle class. The great problem of the French Revolution, then, was to obtain the independence and domination of the third estate. It is expressed in the words of its representative, the Abbé Sieyès: "What are we of the third estate? Nothing. What would we be? Everything." But although the political supremacy of the middle class was the central idea, and the one which it realized, thereby effectually refuting a certain order of politicians that declares violent revolutions to be necessarily abortive, there were issues raised, and not merely raised, but carried for the time being, which went far beyond this. But the flood tide of the revolution did not represent the permanent gain of progress. The waters receded from the ground touched at the height of the crisis, leaving the enfranchisement of the bourgeoisie as the one achievement permanently effected. Foremost among the precursors of this mighty change was the Genevese thinker Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712-1778. This remarkable personality may be termed the messiah of the revolutionary crisis. His writings were quoted and read as a new gospel by well-nigh all the prominent leaders of the time. Rousseau's doctrines were contained in an early essay on civilization, in his Émile, a treatise on education, and in the Social Contract, his chief work. In his first essay, Rousseau maintained the superiority of the savage over the civilized state, and the whole of his subsequent teaching centered in deprecation of the hollowness and artificiality of society, and in an inculcation of the imperative need of a return as far as might be to a state of nature in all our relations. This he especially applies to education in his Émile, in which he sketches the training of a hypothetical child. The Social Contract, his greatest work, contains a discussion of the first principles of social and political order. It is to this work the magic formulas which served as watchwords during the Revolution, formulas such as liberty, equality, and fraternity, divine right of insurrection, the term citizen, employed as a style of address, and many other things are traceable. The title of the work was suggested by Locke's, or rather Hobbes, supposition of a primitive contract having been entered into between governor and governed, which was set up in opposition to that of the divine right of kings. This idea Rousseau accepts in basis, but denies the unconditional nature of the contract affirmed by the originators of the theory. No original distinction existed between rulers and ruled. Any contract of the kind obtained was merely a political convenience strictly subject to conditions. Governors were merely the delegates or mandatories of the people. The form of government was to Rousseau more or less a minor matter. Although a democracy had the most advantages, yet it was quite possible for the mandates of the people to be adequately carried out by a special body of men, an aristocracy, or even by one man, a king. But every form of government was bound to recognize the will of the people as sovereign in all things. The classicism of the French Revolution is also largely represented in Rousseau. The Roman Constitution is invariably the source of his illustrations and the model to be copied or amended. As regards toleration, Rousseau would allow the civil power the right of suppressing views which were deemed contrary to good citizenship. Like the Romans, he would tolerate all religions equally that did not menace the state. There is probably no single book that has produced such stupendous results within a few years, if at all, as Rousseau's Social Contract. It is the textbook of the French Revolution. Every ordinance, every law, every draft of constitution bears the mark of its influence. Although more logical in the working out of the theory than its founders, it is needless to say that Rousseau's own views are singularly barren and unhistorical, as every theory must be that deals only with the political side of things. One may admire his loathing at the artificiality of the world around him, at the organized hypocrisy called religion and morality, but in his day it was impossible to uncover its historical roots, and hence to modern ears his diatribes lose much of their effect. The influence of the second of the important precursors of the French Revolution, François-Marie Arouet de Voltaire, 1694-1778, was much more indirect than that of Rousseau. Voltaire's influence was almost purely negative. By his wit he scorched up all the reverence remaining in the minds of men for the forms of the old, outworn feudal Catholic organization. Though there was a great amount of adroit self-seeking in Voltaire's character, it is as impossible to deny that there was also much that was genuine and truly noble in his indignation at cruelty and his detestation of Christian hypocrisy, as that it produced a far-reaching effect on the events that followed. Voltaire, although personally a Frenchman of Frenchmen, breathes the spirit of a conscious cosmopolitanism and contempt for nationality in his writings, which for the first time in history became a popular creed during the Revolution and was expressed in the famous appeal of 1793. But in this, as in other respects, Voltaire was not alone. He partly created and partly reflected the prevalent tone of the French salon culture of the 18th century. This, if we care to do so, we might trace back in its main features to the revival of learning, to the courts of the Medicis. And here it may be well to remind our readers, in passing, of the truth that individual genius merely means the special faculty of expressing that so-called spirit of the age, to which that of preceding ages has led up, and that Voltaire and Rousseau merely achieved the results they did by reason of their capacity for reproducing in words the shapeless thoughts of millions. To this, in the case of Voltaire, must be added a special width of intellectual sympathy, which took in an unusually large number of different subjects. Besides Rousseau and Voltaire, we must not omit to mention the brilliant group of contemporary workers and thinkers, headed by Diderot and D'Alembert, who built up that monument of laborious industry, the great French Encyclopedia. Immense difficulties attended the publication of this important work, notwithstanding that care was taken to exclude any expressions of overt contempt or hostility towards current prejudices. Again, we must not forget the materialist atheists, central among whom was Baron D'Holbach, the anonymous author of the celebrated System of Nature, a book which, though crude according to modern notions, did good work in its day. Work which a treatise of more intrinsic philosophical value probably would not have achieved. It is noteworthy that most of the other prominent names among the pre-revolutionary writers, including Rousseau and Voltaire, are those of ardent deists. The name of Montesquieu, 1689-1755, whose Esprit des Lois was a textbook of juridical philosophy for the Revolution, must also not be omitted from the list of its literary precursors. All these men contributed their share in preparing the mental foundation for the great upheaval which followed. It is strange, however, that not one of them lived to see the practical issue of his labors. Rousseau, the most directly powerful of them, died 11 years before the taking of the Bastille, and Voltaire the same year. Diderot lived till 1784. D'Alembert died the previous year. Mirabeau, alone of all who had prepared the great crisis, lived to see its beginning. But even he succumbed in 1791, a year and a half before the actual fall of the monarchy. Few of these men saw more than a free-thinking aristocracy and literary class. Of the movement below they recked little, scarcely perhaps that there was such a movement. For although from the beginning of the century, notably throughout the reign of Louis XV, there was ever and anon the consciousness of a change as imminent, and although twice, in 1734 and in 1771, the old system seemed on that point of breaking down in revolution, yet still it survived, and for aught men could tell, was destined to continue to survive many more such shocks. The throne, therefore, doubtless to many, seemed as secure, religion as popular as ever, the same throne and the same religion which in a few years were destined to be involved in so mighty an overthrow. Chapter 2. The Economic Prelude in the Provinces. 10 years of bad harvests aggravated by an effete industrial, fiscal, and political system, culminated with the summer of 1788. A great drought was succeeded by a violent hailstorm which dealt destruction all round. The harvest was worse than ever before. All kinds of agricultural crops failed miserably all over France, not alone wheat and grain generally, but vines, chestnuts, olives. In short, all the natural products of consumption and exportation. Even what was gathered in was so spoiled as to be almost unfit for use. From every province of France came the monotonous tale of ruin, famine, starvation. Even the comparatively well-to-do peasant farmer could obtain nothing but barley bread of a bad quality, and water, while the less well-off had to put up with bread made from dried hay or moistened chaff, which we are told caused the death of many children. The Englishman, Arthur Young, who was travelling through France this year, wherever he went heard nothing but the story of the distress of the people and the dearness of bread. "Such bread as is to be obtained tastes of mould, and often produces dysentery and other diseases. The larger towns present the same condition, as though they had undergone the extremities of a long siege. In some places the whole store of corn and barley has the strength of putrefaction and is full of maggots." To add to the horrors of the situation, upon the hot and dry summer followed a winter of unparalleled severity. The new year of 1789 opened with the Seine frozen over from Paris to Havre. No such weather had been experienced since 1709. As the spring advanced, the misery increased. The industrial crisis became acute in the towns. Thousands of workmen were thrown out of employment owing to the introduction of recently invented machinery from England, which was beginning to supersede hand labor in some trades. The riots and local disturbances which had for many years past been taking place sporadically in various districts now became daily more frequent, so much so that from March onwards the whole peasantry of France may be said to have been in a state of open insurrection, 300 separate risings in the provinces being counted for the 4 months preceding the taking of the Bastille. In 1787, the minister Loménie de Brienne had created 19 new provincial assemblies. Below the arrondissement, or district assembly, which had been instituted some years before, now came the assembly of the parish. In each of these primary assemblies of the parish, the arrondissement, and even of the province, the people, farmers, etc., sat side by side with the local dignitaries, a fact which, as may be imagined, considerably tended to obliterate the ancient feudal awe. In November 1787, the king announced his intention of convoking the States-General. On the 5th of July 1788, the various local bodies were called upon to draw up cahiers, or statements of their grievances, for a presentment before the king and States-General, in which a double representation of the Third Estate was conceded. These cahiers form a mass of the most interesting material illustrative of the condition of France just before the Revolution, and have not even yet been fully investigated. "The king," said the proclamation, "desires that from the extremities of his kingdom, and the least known of its habitations, each may feel assurance in bringing before him his views and grievances." And this and other similar expressions were interpreted by the peasantry in the natural sense that the king was really desirous of rescuing them from starvation. It accordingly emboldened them to take the matter into their own hands. In January, the cahiers were drawn up, which meant that the people had now for the first time formulated their ills. Discussion in the assemblies had excited them. The States-General was going to look to their wrongs, it was true, but the States-General did not meet till May, and meanwhile they were starving. One thing was clear, they must have bread. Accordingly, in defiance of local authorities and guardians of the peace, bands ranging up to 300 or 400 and more formed themselves all over France, seized and plundered granaries, religious houses, stores of all kinds, entered public buildings in the name of the people, destroying all legal documents, justly regarded as the instruments of their servitude, which they could lay their hands on, proclaimed the local dues and taxes abolished, summarily put to death all those who interfered with them in the name of law and order, and, emboldened by success, finally took to the burning of the chateau and the indiscriminate destruction and appropriation of the houses and property of the wealthy. That the numbers of these bands were augmented not only by the workmen out of employment in Paris, Rouen, etc., but also by professional thieves, was only to be expected. The local authorities were hopelessly inadequate to cope with the insurgents, and central authority in Paris seemed paralyzed. Ordinarily, readers of the history of the Revolution are apt to forget, in following the course of events in the metropolis, that they were only an enlarged picture of what was going on in hundreds of towns and villages throughout the provinces. Both before and after the famous 14th of July, in most of the provinces of France, all constituted authority was at an end. No one durst disobey the mandates of the popular insurgents. It would be impossible, and tedious if it were possible, to enumerate all the circumstances of even the principal revolts. The manner was pretty much the same in all, and the following account of an insurrection at Strasbourg may serve to illustrate it. 500 or 600 peasants, artisans, unemployed, tramps, and others seized the occasion of a public holiday to attack the Hôtel de Ville, the assembled magistrates escaping precipitately by back doors. The windows disappear under a volley of stones, the doors are broken in with crowbars, and the crowd enters like a torrent. Immediately, the account states, there was a rain of shutters, window-sashes, chairs, tables, sofas, books, papers, etc. The public archives are thrown to the winds, the neighboring streets being covered with them. Deeds, charters, etc., perish in the flames. In the cellars, tuns containing valuable wines are forced, the marauders, after drinking their fill, allowing them to run until there is a pond formed 5 feet deep, in which several people are drowned. Others, loaded with booty, run off with it under the eyes of the soldiers, who rather encourage the proceedings than otherwise. For 3 whole days the city is given over to the mob. All the houses belonging to persons of local distinction are sacked from cellar to attic. The revolt spreads instantly throughout the neighboring country. Note 1. 10 Origine, Tome 1, pages 81-82. Return to text. A few weeks before the opening of the States-General, a great riot occurred in Paris in the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, the workmen's quarter, attended by much bloodshed and loss of life. Paris, we are told, had for months past begun to fill with desperate, hungry, and ragged strangers, drawn thither by poverty from the uttermost ends of France. In some districts, the leaders pretend to be acting under the orders of the king. The result is everywhere at least one thing: the enforcement of a maximum in the price of bread and the abolition of taxes. Atrocities, of course, occur here and there. A lawyer is half-roasted to make him surrender a charter supposed to be in his possession. A lord is tortured to death, an ecclesiastic torn in pieces. Thus have threatened ruin and starvation, to which the financial extravagances of the court have been the occasion of giving articulate expression, and the remedy for which is offered to those who can read in the social contract of Rousseau, become the immediate cause of the French Revolution. The same imminent bankruptcy of the kingdom, occasioned by the extravagance of the court, which led to the convocation of the States-General, led also indirectly to the founding of that mainspring of the Revolution, the Jacobin Club. The dispute between the court and the local legal councils, called parliaments, led to the crippling of their powers by the king, and this again to remonstrant deputations from the aggrieved provincial towns. One set of these remonstrants, hailing from Rennes in Brittany, formed themselves into a club called the Breton Club, for the ventilation of their grievances, using the old convent of Saint-Jacques in the Rue Saint-Honoré for their meetings. The original scope of the society soon became enlarged, and the name changed from that of Breton Club to Jacobin Club, after their meeting-place. Such was the origin of the vast club organization which exercised such a stupendous influence not only in Paris but in France during the following years. Chapter 3. The Opening in Paris. On the 5th of May 1789 the royal town of Versailles was gay with decorations, with music, vocal and instrumental, with epaulettes, etiquette, fair women and fair costumes. It was the opening of the States-General, called together for the first time since 1614, as a last resource to rescue the realm from dissolution and impending bankruptcy, and also the definitive opening of the French Revolution. At midday might have been seen the feudal procession entering the church of Saint-Louis. After the king and royal family, the clergy occupied the first place, the superior clergy, attired in purple robe and lawn sleeves, the less superior in cassock, cloak, and square bonnet. Next came the nobles, habited in black with silver-faced vest, lace cravat, and plumed hat, while bringing up the rear followed the humble tiers-état, the representatives of the middle class, the merchants, the farmers, and the small landowners, dressed also in black, but adorned with merely a short cloak and plain hat. With this memorable procession, the constitution of the Middle Ages, moribund for over two centuries, spasmodically gasped its last breath. The business of the States-General did not pass off as gaily as the opening ceremony. Conflict between the orders followed immediately on points of procedure, with the result that the Third Estate constituted itself the National Assembly of France, refusing to admit the other orders to its deliberations except on a basis of equality. The King manifested his displeasure by closing the door of the Hall of the States against them. The Assembly answered by the celebrated oath it took outside in the tennis court of Versailles, 20th June, by which it pledged itself not to separate until it had given France a constitution. The Assembly triumphed over the court 2 days after its oath, inasmuch as it regained possession of its hall, openly defied the King in person, abolished the independence of the clergy and noblesse, formally confirmed its decrees of the previous day which the King had quashed, and proceeded with its deliberations. Thus the curtain rose on the first act of the revolutionary drama. Meanwhile, the new popular ferment, occasioned by the events at Versailles, had taken complete possession of the capital, and was rapidly spreading into the provinces. Some weeks later, early in July, Necker, the Minister of Finance, beloved by the middle class, was dismissed from office. Necker, it should be observed, was one of the less bad of the scoundrels, called finance ministers, who have been malversating the national funds in succession for years past. By comparison, he appeared almost virtuous, and the populace, whose charity and admiration are always boundless toward official personages, when not quite so bad as one would expect, had converted him into an object of adoration. A procession for the purpose of protesting against the minister's dismissal was dispersed by force of arms and two persons killed. The city was soon in an uproar. The Palais Royal, the great place of public assembly and political discussion, was packed with over 10,000 persons. On the table, which served for a tribune, stood a young man of fine features and gentle mien, who was haranguing the crowd. It was Camille Desmoulins, the popular journalist. "Citizens," said he, "there is not a moment to lose. The removal of Necker is the tocsin for a St. Bartholomew of patriots. This evening all the Swiss and German battalions are coming from the Champ de Mars to slaughter us. There remains but one resource. Let us rush to arms." So saying, he placed in his hat a sprig of a tree, green being the emblem of hope. The example was followed till the chestnut trees of Paris were denuded. At the same time, the tricolor flag was first adopted as the banner of the popular party. The crowd proceeded through the streets, bearing in triumph the bust of Necker and Philippe Égalité, the king's cousin, but not his friend, its numerical strength increasing with every yard traversed, till its course was arrested on the Pont Royal by a detachment of the Royal German Cavalry. The latter was driven back by showers of stones, and the concourse swept onwards as far as the Place Louis XV. Here a formidable street fight took place, the people being opposed by a squadron of dragoons. The regulars of the king, after encountering a vigorous resistance, at length routed the insurgent Parisians, but the victory was more fatal to the cause they represented than any defeat could have been. The dispersed multitude carried the indignant cry, "To arms!" from end to end of Paris. The regiment of French guards quartered in Paris mutinied, and put to flight the mercenary foreign troops intended to overawe them. The whole night long the tocsin rang out from the Hôtel de Ville, where a committee of prominent citizens was sitting to organize a search for arms. The morning of the 12th of July saw Paris in full revolt. The tocsins of all the churches were pealing. Drums were beating along all the main streets. Excited crowds collecting in every opening space. An influx of the disinherited class trooped in at all the gates of Paris. Gunsmiths' shops were ransacked. On all sides a mad search for weapons was the order of the day. The committee at the Hôtel de Ville, in response to the importunate demands for arms, could only reply that they had none. The civic authorities next appealed to, temporized, and evasively promised assistance. Houses were sacked, carriages seized. In the confusion there were naturally not wanting ruffians who sought to make use of the state of things prevailing for purposes of mere plunder. such excesses were peremptorily put down with the cry, "Death to the thieves!" The equipages and other property of the aristocrats, when seized by the people, were always either destroyed or carried to a central station at the Place de Grève. In the afternoon, the provost of the merchants, a dignitary of the effete medieval hierarchy corresponding to the modern mayor, announced the speedy arrival of the muskets and ammunition so eagerly clamored for on all sides. A citizen militia was formed under the name of the Parisian Guard, numbering 48,000 men. Cockades of red, blue, and green were everywhere distributed, but the hours passed on, and no muskets arrived. A panic seized the city that the mercenary troops were about to march on Paris during the ensuing night. At last, chests purporting to contain ammunition did appear, were eagerly torn open, and found to contain old linen and broken pieces of wood. The committee men and the provost of the merchants alike narrowly escaped with their lives. But the provost, pleading that he had been himself deceived, tried to divert the attention of the people by sending them on a futile expedition to Chartreux. The committee finally hit upon the device of arming the citizens with pikes in default of firearms, and accordingly ordered 50,000 to be forged. As a measure of protection against thieves and plunderers, the city was illuminated throughout the night. Chapter 4. The Bastille. Next morning, the 14th, early, the word was passed among the populace, to the Invalides, the military hospital. There, at least, arms must be forthcoming. And sure enough, the people were rewarded for their courage in braving the troops assembled in the Champ de Mars and forcing their way into the great military depot. 28,000 muskets, besides cannon, sabres, and spears, were carried off in triumph. Meanwhile, the alarm had been given that the royal regiments posted at Saint-Denis were on the way to the capital, and above all, that the cannon of the Bastille itself was pointed toward the Boulevard Saint-Antoine. The attention of Paris was at once directed to the former point, which really commanded the most populous districts of the city. The whole morning there was but one cry, "To the Bastille!" The Bastille was the great emblem of the king's authority. In the Middle Ages it had been the royal stronghold against the turbulent feudal barons. But though the French nobility had long ceased to be turbulent barons, and had become obsequious courtiers, the Bastille remained, nevertheless, the great visible embodiment of the, at present, long-centralized authority of the King of France. The capture of the Bastille would therefore be the greatest blow the king's prestige could possibly suffer. Add to this that although no longer employed for its original purpose, the Bastille had become specially obnoxious, owing to its use as a place for arbitrary imprisonment under the infamous lettre de cachet. Armed crowds assembled then at this place from all quarters till the great fortress seemed confronted by the whole city in arms. Negotiations took place with the governor de Launay, but the people persistently shouted, "We want the Bastille!" The die was cast by the destruction of the great bridge, which was battered down by blows from hatchets, it is said, by two men only. The concourse poured in. The second drawbridge was attacked and vigorously defended by the small garrison. Numbers of the assailants fell, killed, and wounded. The siege continued over 4 hours, when the French guard, who, as we have seen, had already sided with the revolution, arrived with cannon. The garrison, seeing the case hopeless, themselves urged the governor to surrender. But old de Launay preferred blowing the place up and burying himself amidst the ruins. His companions alone prevented him from carrying out this design. The soldiers thereupon surrendered on condition that their lives should be spared. The leaders of the people who were in the forefront and had given their word to this effect did their utmost to protect the garrison from the indignation of the crowd. But among the thousands that thronged in there were probably few who knew anything of what had taken place. As a consequence, de Launay and some of the Swiss garrison fell victims to the popular fury. Meanwhile, the Hôtel de Ville was in trepidation. Above all, the provost of the merchants, Plessel, trembled lest he should be made to suffer for his treachery. These fears were not allayed when shouts of "Victory! Liberty!" issuing from thousands of throats assailed the ears of the inmates, and grew louder minute by minute. It was the conquerors of the Bastille carrying their heroes in triumph to the municipal headquarters. Presently there entered the great hall an enthusiastic but disorderly, ragged, and blood-stained crowd, promiscuously armed with pikes, muskets, hatchets, and well-nigh every other conceivable weapon. Above the heads of the crowd one held the keys of the Bastille, another the regulations of the prison, a third the collar of the governor. A general amnesty for all the defenders captured was agreed to after much opposition. But the provost of the merchants did not get off so easily. On the corpse of Delaunay a letter had been found in which Flesselles had stated that he was amusing the Parisians with cockades and promises, and that if the fortress could only hold out till nightfall, relief should come. A court was to have been improvised in the Palais Royal to judge him, but on the way thither he was laid dead by a pistol shot from one of the crowd. The excitement of the day's action over, precautions to avert designs against the capital on the part of the court were redoubled. Everywhere barricades were raised, paving stones torn up, pikes forged. The whole population was all night long at work in the streets. How well grounded were the fears of the Parisians would have been evident to anyone behind the scenes at Versailles, where Breteuil, the prime minister, had just promised the king to restore the royal authority in 3 days, this very night having been fixed for the expedition, and wine and presents distributed among the royal troops in anticipation. The assembly, which was sitting en permanence, was about to send one more deputation to the king, it had already sent two, when he appeared in person in its midst. On being informed during the night of the events that had taken place by the grand master of the wardrobe, he exclaimed, "It is a revolt." "No, sire," replied the grand master, "it is a revolution." On the king's subsequent protestations of affection for his subjects, and his statement that he had just been given orders for the withdrawal of the foreign troops from Paris and Versailles, that he confided his person to the representatives of the nation alone, etc., the assembly gave way to transports of joy, rose en masse, and escorted him to the palace. The news spread rapidly. A revulsion of feeling took place all round, from terror to elation, from hatred to gratitude. The general jubilation was increased by the restoration of Necker, the entry of Louis XVI into Paris, and his acceptance of the tricolor cockade. Thus ended the preparatory period of the revolution. It is needless to say the moral effect of the popular victory throughout France was immense, every town becoming henceforth a revolutionary centre in the sense of possessing a definite revolutionary organization. There are one or two useful hints to be learned from this old and oft-repeated story of the fall of the Bastille. The first is of the eminent utility of popular force, if only applied at the right moment. Beforehand, it would have seemed preposterous that an undisciplined mob could take a fortress and paralyze the efforts of a reaction possessed of a trained army. Yet so it was. Another point to note is the untrustworthiness of men who belong to the class which makes the revolution, and who even profess to represent it when their personal interests and position are bound up with the maintenance of the existing order. Flesselles, a man of the third estate, its leading dignitary in the city of Paris, was yet the man who was the least anxious to see the feudal hierarchy overthrown. And why? Because he played a part in it. The third estate had been incorporated into the medieval system. He was its representative as one of the feudal orders. Its position was subordinate indeed, but, now that it was growing in importance, its leading men had much more to gain by clinging to the skirts of the noblesse, and aiding them in frustrating that complete revolution which the rank and file of the class were seeking, than in assisting the accomplishment of this revolution, which could only mean the effacement of their own personal position. History repeats itself. Trade unions have won for themselves recognition and patronage in the middle-class world today. Their leaders, in a similar way, do not exhibit any special desire for a change which, though it would mean the liberation and triumph of the class they represent, would at the same time render trade unions a thing of the past, no less than the Lord Mayors and Cabinet Ministers who stroke the backs of the parliamentary elect of trades unions. No, verily, this is not a nice prospect for the trade union leaders. End of chapters 1 through 4. Chapters 5 through 8 of The Story of the French Revolution by Ernest Belford Bax. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 5. The Constitution Mongers. The Constitution was now in full train. The revolution up to the latter point was officially recognized. There was no harking back for anyone. Foulon and Berthier, two administrators of the first rank under the old regime, had been publicly hanged à la lanterne and quartered by the people. The first stratum of revolutionists was to the fore. Mirabeau, Lafayette, and Bailly are the central figures of the Constituent Assembly. Duport, Barnave, and Lamette its extreme men. The Comte de Mirabeau, 1749-1791, one of the pre-revolutionary writers, was the leader of the moderate party in the Assembly. His stupendous powers of oratory made him a useful ally and a dangerous foe. This the court was not slow in discovering, and accordingly Mirabeau was soon won over by bribes to do his best to frustrate every popular measure in the Assembly, while all the time professing devotion to the cause of liberty and the people. When this failed, the popular orator did not disdain to resort to actual plotting. The Marquis de Lafayette, 1757-1834, of American independence notoriety, another member of the noblesse, who had adopted previously to the Revolution the quasi-advanced views then fashionable with his class, was the military representative of the moderate party in his capacity of commandant of the National Guard, besides the henchman of Mirabeau in the Assembly. Bailly, 1736-1793, who was elected mayor of Paris the day after the taking of the Bastille, also coadjutated in the work of moderating the Revolution alike in his official capacity and in the Assembly. As to the extreme men, they really represented but the most moderate form of constitutional monarchy. The situation of parties may be estimated by the fact that Barnave advocated a suspensory veto on the part of the king, while Mirabeau strenuously supported the absolute veto. And be it remembered, at such a time, the right of vetoing obnoxious measures would have been no mere matter of form. It appears, then, that even the most advanced parliamentarians of the day were not prepared to go beyond the present Prussian constitution. Nevertheless, circumstances early forced upon this timid and comparatively reactionary assembly some drastic political measures, first and foremost on the memorable night of the 4th of August, the abolition of all seigneurial rights and privileges. At a later stage, after the Assembly had removed to Paris, a little judicious coercion from the tribunes or people's galleries, which were tenanted by advanced revolutionists, there is no doubt exercised a salutary influence on several occasions. The members knew well enough that their lives were in the hands of the Paris populace, and those of their wives and children, besides their property, at the mercy of the populace of the rural districts. The Assembly's first important performance after the fall of the Bastille was the Declaration of the Rights of Man, in imitation of the Americans after the successful termination of the War of Independence. The Declaration of the Rights of Man contains a series of articles laying down the principles of political equality. Most of them are unexceptionable and even trite, but it is significant that number 17 affirms categorically the absolute sacredness of private property. The question which arose immediately subsequent to this on the constitution of the chamber and its relations to the king need not detain us. It is sufficient to state that while the assembly was amusing itself discussing suspensory veto or absolute veto, the court, viz., queen and company at Versailles, were meditating the transference of the king to Metz, where the mercenary German troops were stationed, and whence communication with the French noblesse who had emigrated and the reactionary foreign powers was easy, the idea being to declare Paris and the Assembly rebels and march upon the city with the view of restoring the absolute monarchy. These machinations at Versailles are interesting as having given the direction to the first great demonstration of the proletariat of Paris during the Revolution. I say the direction, as the proximate cause was the advice the now rising popular journalist Marat had given some days before in his Amis du Peuple, when discussing the scarcity of bread. The revolt broke out in this way. A woman, beating a drum, patrolled the streets, crying, "Bread! Bread!" She was soon surrounded by larger numbers of women, who repaired to the Hôtel de Ville, demanding bread and arms, at the same time raising the cry, "To Versailles!" which was taken up by the populace generally, with the suddenness characteristic of Parisian outbreaks. The National Guard and the French Guard eventually joined in with such persistence and unanimity that Lafayette, after some hours of expostulation, was compelled to place himself at their head, the troops having begun to march without him. The unexpected appearance of a concourse headed by women and backed by a large armed force naturally threw the queen and court into a state of amazement and admiration, in the Shakespearean sense. The household troops at once surrounded the palace. The women, however, expressed peaceable intentions, and through their spokeswoman laid their grievances before the king and the assembly, describing the direness of the famine prevailing. Meanwhile, in the courtyard of the palace, which was filled with a motley crowd, a quarrel arose, an officer of the king's troops having struck a national guard. This was the signal for an immediate conflict between the two armed bodies. The people and the nationals were furious, and the collision must have resulted in more bloodshed than it did, had it not been for the darkness of the night, and the prudent order given the royal soldiers to cease from firing and to retreat. The disturbance was eventually quelled, the crowds melting away gradually as the night advanced. The royal family retired to rest at 2 o'clock. Lafayette, who had remained up all night, in vain endeavored to snatch repose for an hour after 5 a.m. Before 6, some members of the previous evening's crowd who had remained at Versailles insulted one of the bodyguard, who drew upon them, wounding one of their number. The sleepless hero of two worlds, so called from his American adventures, was soon upon the scene. He found considerable remnants of yesterday's gathering furiously forcing their way into the palace. The assailants were temporarily dispersed, but soon reassembled, clamoring for the king. The king eventually appeared upon the balcony, promising in reply to the popular demands that he would go to Paris with his family. The queen, the head and front of all the recent offending, next stepped on the balcony in the company of the arch-courtier Lafayette, who, with a profound obeisance, kissed the hand of the woman who had been plotting the massacre of that very people for whom this hypocritical charlatan had been all along professing zeal and devotion. But the humiliation of the Parisians was not yet ended. Lafayette, retiring, reappeared with one of the obnoxious bodyguard, and placing the tricolor cockade upon his breast, embraced him. At each of these points the assembled crowd duly cheered. The royal family then set out for Paris, and the Tuileries became henceforth their permanent residence. Chapter 6. The New Constitution. After the events we have just described, which occurred on the 5th and 6th of October 1789, the course of the revolution was for some considerable time peaceful and parliamentary. The assembly, till then at Versailles, soon followed the court to Paris. Its migration seemed the signal for a vigorous application of the pickaxe to the old feudal system by this hitherto moderate body. The chief bulwark attacked was the property and independent organization of the Church. Prior to this, however, the assembly had reconstituted the map of France by abolishing the old division into provinces, substituting for it the present one into departments. The provinces had in the Middle Ages formed de facto independent states. The division into departments placed the whole realm under one central administration, and included the entire reorganization of the judicial system. There were 83 departments formed, which were divided into districts, and these into cantons. The department had its administrative council and executive directory, as had also the district. The canton was merely an electoral subdivision. The commune, or township, was confided to a general council and a municipality, which were subordinated to the departmental council. All elections were indirect, and the whole scheme in this respect seemed carefully arranged to exclude, as far as possible, the working classes and peasantry from any effective voice in legislation. The nationalization of the church lands and property generally was precipitated by the old trouble, the exhausted state of the treasury. Necker had devised every conceivable plan for raising the wind and failed, when the last-named project was suggested as a means of at least temporarily satisfying the exigencies of the situation. It would be tiresome in a sketch like the present to describe in detail the stages by which the assembly arrived at the final result. The issue of its deliberations, to wit, the decree expropriating the church, was carried on the 2nd of December, and thenceforth the churchmen as a body became the determined enemies of the new régime. At first the clergy seemed more inclined than the noblesse to compromise matters, in the hope of retaining their wealth, but now that the die was cast, they were implacable. The difficulties attending the sale of the ecclesiastical property, however, were too great to admit of its realization in time for the pressing needs of the exchequer, hence the issue of assignats, or notes having a forced currency based on the value of the expropriated lands. This, which meant the adoption of a system of paper money on a vast scale, staved off the imminent financial ruin. All these measures were very interesting, and showed a laudable activity on the part of the body politic, but they did not affect the crowds to be seen daily at the bakers' shops, ever and anon breaking out into tumult. The working classes of Paris had gone to Versailles demanding simply bread, and Lafayette had given them the royal family. Any further grumbling was obviously to be suppressed with drastic measures. Accordingly, martial law was proclaimed, and the municipality empowered to forcibly disperse any assembly of people having once summoned them to retire. Lafayette was there to put this regulation into effect at the first opportunity, but it did not come yet. The clubs were now beginning to play a leading part in influencing public opinion. The principal were those of the Jacobins and the Cordeliers. A third club was instituted subsequently by Lafayette, called the Feuillants, and representing constitutional principles. The Jacobins' club, destined hereafter to become the great unofficial expression of the Revolution, counted but few prominent adherents in the Assembly, though Bernave and the Lamettes were among its members, and it was occasionally patronized by several of the constitution-makers, including Mirabeau himself. One cadaverous figure, also a deputy, was always at the Jacobins, his dress and speeches alike carefully prepared, by name Maximilien Robespierre, by profession advocate, a native of Arras. The club of the Cordeliers was composed of an advanced section of the Jacobins. Among its constant attendants might have been seen the stalwart yeoman Danton and the short, thick-set, sharp-featured journalist Marat. But neither the clubs nor their rising orators at this time exercised more than an indirect influence on the course of events, though they energetically debated every question as it arose. Meanwhile, in spite of the occasional disturbances and panics as to the king plotting his flight, affairs moved along with comparative smoothness towards the completion of the constitution, the consummation of the middle-class political order. Preparations for celebrating the anniversary of the fall of the Bastille with due solemnity went on apace. A national confederation was to be held in the Champ de Mars on this occasion in honor of the constitution. The advanced members of the noblesse, not to be behind in patriotism, proposed in view of the national fête the abolition of titles, armorial bearings, and the feudal insignia generally. The proposition was enthusiastically carried by the assembly. Its result was naturally to rouse the keenest indignation among the nobles outside, and to give further edge to the organized movement of the aristocratic emigration. On the 14th of July, 1790, the population of Paris, notwithstanding bad weather, were to be seen streaming from all sides in holiday attire amid a blaze of tricolor, banners, hangings, cockades, to the Champ de Mars, where a gigantic altar had been erected in the center of a vast artificial amphitheater. The royal family, the assembly, and the municipality were grouped around this altar, before which the then popular bishop of Autun, Talleyrand, subsequently the famous diplomatist and wit, performed mass in high pontifical robes, assisted by 400 clergy in white surplices. Lafayette first ascended the altar, and in the name of the national guards of the whole realm took the civic oath of fidelity to the nation, the law, and the king. This was followed by a salvos of artillery and prolonged shouts of Vive la nation! Vive le roi! The president of the assembly and all the deputies, the department councils, etc., next took the same oath. But the grand item of the day's program was reached when Louis XVI himself rose to swear, as King of France, to maintain the constitution decreed by the assembly. This part of the performance terminated, as usual on great occasions, with the appearance of the queen holding the dauphin up aloft to the homage and admiration of the assembled multitude, who responded in one long and continuous acclamation. Chants of thanksgiving and exalted jubilation generally closed the day's proceedings. Such was the inauguration of the first French constitution. But despite the new and glorious liberty, crowds of hungry Parisians continued to be daily turned away from the bakers' shops. Chapter 7. A Constitution on its beam ends. All state functionaries, military, civic, and ecclesiastical, were now compelled to take the oath of allegiance to the new order of things. This led to a revolt on the part of the majority of the nobles and ecclesiastics, whose indignation was already roused to boiling point by the loss respectively of their privileges and revenues. Numbers of aristocratic officers left the army and the country to join their brethren across the frontier. Others, such as Bouillé, gave in with the view of gaining over the army for the counter-revolution. The regular army at this time was almost entirely officered by aristocrats, a fact which gave rise to numerous revolts. A mutiny of 3 regiments at Nancy was only quelled after much bloodshed by Bouillé. Most of the clergy refused either to take the oath of allegiance or to leave their...
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.